It's time for Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking. And now, here's Tupelo Tom and Big Lou.
I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou. And we're talking.
Yeah, good. Hey, good day.
That's pretty. Wow. We've been out of practice.
Every time we do it, it gets better and better. I went back listened to some older episodes, and we're really in sync now.
Yeah, it's like a fine wine. It just gets better with time.
And everybody knows it's the stuff at the very beginning of the podcast that's the thing people sample first. So if we're in sync at the beginning, you know, by the time they get to the end, they're pretty, you know, they're on top of things. So
they're in sync.
They're
with
in sync
us.
With us. That's right. But it's the latest edition. Our producer Alex Mitchell is out there somewhere. Hello, Alex, in Myrtle Beach.
Hey, Myrtle Beach. It's beautiful here. It's hot.
Well, yeah, it's summertime in the South, boys.
Mm. Yeah, hot time in Florida.
Rainy night in Georgia. You know,
rainy night in Georgia.
And we are on this episode. This is one I've been looking forward to. This is kind of the one I had circled all year. Ever since birthday, when Elvis' birthday around January the 8th, I was hosting events there in Memphis, and we had Wink Martindale with us live in Memphis, and he told this amazing story about being in the room the night that That's All Right Mama was played on WHBQ by Dewey Phillips, and he's a guest on our show, Big Lou and Alex, and I'm very happy that he was able to make time for us.
Me too. I mean, Wink's such a great guy. You meet him once, you're friends with him, and he's such an energetic guy. And his voice, oh my God, it's as incredible today as it was when he first started, if not better. And of course, Sandy's wonderful as well. And this is a really cool moment for us. This is great.
Yeah, and to be able to be friends with a guy who had a dream job for me. I always wanted to be a game show host. I mean, I wanted to be Johnny Carson, and I wanted to be a game show host. So getting to know him, and there was a year at the Nashville Elvis Festival that we had Wink and Sandy, his wife, along with us as a guest, and I got to work on a quiz show with Wink and write questions and have him go back and reword the questions where it was smarter and better. And I have all his notes to this day of all of the game show notes that I got from Wink Martindale, who's, you know, he's the king of game shows.
Howard Stern, his show has a character now of a guy that imitates Wink because his voice was so cool. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, this guy's a legend.
Yeah. And there's a football coach, I think, named Wink Martindale.
Yeah, so, Wink Martindale. Yeah. That's right.
So I want to lead off this episode, though. We'll have Wink a little bit later in the show, but the thing that was on every...
Hang on, Tom. I just want you to say that again, that we're going to have Wink on a little bit later in the show. I don't think... That's probably the coolest sentence I've ever heard you say.
So Wink Martindale's going to be a little later in the show. We've got some other things to talk about before he joins us. That does sound pretty cool, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does. Well, Wink's going to join us. Like, just want to let y'all know.
We think we have other stuff more important. We're hilarious.
I'm sorry, ma'am. I can't talk now. Wink's about to join us. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, go ahead.
The end of May into early June, the internet was swept with news that Graceland was going to be foreclosed on. A lawsuit had been launched against the Presley estate by a company saying that it was a loan taken out by Lisa Marie for $3.8 million, and it had not been paid back. So her collateral for this loan was Graceland Mansion and all its possessions for just $3.8 million is all she wanted in the loan. And to me, what it showed, I mean, immediately my reaction was scam, just like mm-hmm. these emails we get all the time saying all that time. We do. But it immediately proved once again how no one will actually click on the story and read the story and use their own intuitiveness to go, well, this is a scam. And they're just looking for a reason to slam down on people and start talking about, I can't believe Lisa would do this. How terrible she did this. I'm sure Priscilla's involved. Oh, my God, negative, negative, negative. And I just thought, wow, there's just a lot of people that don't have enough time in their lives to click on something and actually read it and sound somewhat intelligent.
I was seeing full discussions from people.
Mm-hmm.
Just shaking my head going, can you not read? Is that? And then somebody would come up and go, clearly none of you read this. What are you guys talking about? Yeah. You know, and it was just, you know, the only time when I first saw it, I just assumed it was a made up story. Then all of a sudden it's on USA Today, it's on Fox News, it's on y'all. Like, wait a minute, what? And I knew, everybody knew it was ridiculous. You read through it and you go, oh my God, this is a joke. And what I loved Then they mess with Riley.
Yeah.
Who has a few people on her team.
And she's pretty smart. She's in a thing called show business already. Yeah, she's got people, you know, you've heard of people that have a team of lawyers. Riley has a team of lawyers. Right. And her lawyers have better firms than this mysterious agency that even in the initial article, no one could find any information about this company.
Yeah.
The person who was the notary on the lawsuit said, I've never heard of this lawsuit. The person whose name was associated with the ownership of the company said, I don't know what you're talking about. It was everything pointing to scam, but naysayers being how they are, they say nay, nay to facts and let's move on. It's just like a year or two ago, Kanye West said, I'm going to buy Graceland and move in. And everybody was like, oh my God, I can't believe they'd let him do that. And like, he's talking. Right. It's what I've discovered is there are certain subjects that if you mention them, they will get carriage. They will get a headline. People are looking for clicks.
Yeah.
Now, the sad thing is a lot of these Elvis fans didn't give them what they wanted, which was the click, because they really need that click to monetize. People were just going. But what I thought was interesting was this thing played out and it was over in like 7 days. It was created on Tuesday and it was over by the following Monday or Tuesday. But this is what was released a few days after they got rid of the lawsuit. Because actually the company, and I have that in quotes, decided, well, you know what? This is just too much controversy. We're going to withdraw our lawsuit. Oh, really? You're going to walk away from that $3.8 million that Lisa Marie owes you? Yeah. Really? You're going to this is just too hard for you. This email was released. It was written in Spanish. To all the press, I am the Yahoo ringleader of Nigeria. I have Google worms in the United States. The Pressly, P-R-S-L-Y, is made up and a hoax. And it basically goes on to say, it's something I invented to get my worms to get money. As you know, we Nigerian Yahoos have been doing this for many years. We steal U.S. birth and death certificates, hack into people's accounts, make up addresses, steal identities, search everything and hack all kinds of records. We hurt innocent people who don't know that we took their identity and used innocent people's name to do it. So that's all it was.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Here's the bottom line on the whole thing. Graceland and EPE had nothing to do with this. Lisa Marie had nothing to do with this. It was a scam, people. And it's over and it's gone away. And there's a lot of people that may not know it's gone away. They may think, well, we better go to Graceland quickly because, you know, they're going to sell it for 3.8 million. You know what would have made this more believable? If they had said the lawsuit was $200 million or $250 million, but 3.8? Right. That's t-shirt sales.
I know a football coach named Wink Martindale who could pay that tomorrow. I'm just pointing that out.
I know a game show host who could pay that tomorrow. So that's our, you know, Graceland's not being sold in foreclosure. And I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings, but the fact that I may have done that, if you can't click on the story to read the whole thing, then you probably don't know how to click on a podcast. So you probably will never hear this.
Amen.
There you go. The other thing that has come up, and I found this one, you know how sometimes kind of like that story of the foreclosure just comes out of nowhere. This one came out of nowhere on June 3rd, a press release was issued. And I get press releases, Jeff, because I know people. Today, June 3rd, Random House announced a new Lisa Marie Presley memoir scheduled for release on October 15th. It's called From Here to the Great Unknown. It features a photo of young Lisa Marie with her father, Elvis. It's basically an autobiography that is coming out, and it's taken from tapes that Lisa Marie had made talking about her life with Elvis and her life growing up at Graceland and her life as a Presley. And it's being completed by Riley Keough, her daughter. And in 2022, Lisa Marie asked her daughter to help her finally finish that book. And a month later, Lisa was gone. And they say the world would never know her own story in her own words, never know the passionate, joyful, caring, and complicated woman that Riley loved and grieved. And so Riley got the tapes that her mom had recorded, laid in her bed, listened to her mother tell her story about smashing golf carts together in the yards of Graceland, about the unconditional love she felt from her father, about being upstairs, just the two of them. She heard her mom talking about getting dragged screaming out of the bathroom as she ran towards his body on the floor when he had passed away, about living in L.A. with her mother, getting sent to school after school, always getting kicked out, always in trouble, and about her lifelong relationship with Danny, which is Riley's father, Danny Keough. So she heard all of these, and she wanted to do this book to let people know who her mother was.
I love that.
And to be gifted this information in June, knowing that a book is coming in October, it's one thing to know about it years in advance, but it'll be here in a few months. It's just amazing that this gift has been given to us. And again, Riley just again proves how smart she is and how she feels about her mother, the way all of us do, kind of as a member of our family, too.
Yes.
As an Elvis fan.
Man, thank God for Riley. She has just done so much already. And you can tell it's just so genuine from that Christmas special.
Yeah.
What a blessing we have between Baz and the film and Riley. We've got a whole new surge of Elvis in our life. It's just fantastic.
It continues to fascinate me because I keep a little file throughout the month between sessions of us doing this podcast. And every month I think, well, I hope we have a guest next month because there won't be anything to talk about. And Jeff, there's always, we've got, besides Wink, we have six other subjects to talk about from the Elvis world just in this month.
Yeah.
It just continues on. And as you've said before, every time we go to a festival, every time we're on stage, there are new people there. There are first time fans coming to festivals. There are younger and younger fans coming. And I'm seeing, goodness gracious, there's more 5, 6, 7, 8 year olds than I've ever seen. Yeah. There's something about this man's music and his life and his style that continues to speak to people.
And I won't mention his name because I can't remember it, but he's a young man. I think he's 15 right now that I was played some videos of, who is obsessed with Elvis now. And just based on the videos, his look, his voice, everything, he's another great one coming up the pike. And we got a lot of young ETAs, Elvis tribute artists doing this. But what I found interesting about this young man, he had heard of Elvis before, but it wasn't until Baz's film. That's what got him into Elvis. Now he's everything Elvis, going back into the old Elvis, you know, records and interviews and everything. He's an obsessed fan like we are. And here's a young ETA coming up who is doing this and is obsessed with Elvis and loves Elvis because of the film, because of something new, because of something that was released. Like the people that hear new artists, contemporary artists doing Elvis's music. Well, wait, I want to hear the original of that. It's just, it's a fascinating phenomenon.
And it shows that movie, how that movie has given Elvis to this younger generation with no filter of a grandmother or a grandfather or a mother. He's not someone else's singer. He's theirs.
Yes.
They've discovered him through Austin, through Baz, through everyone in the film. The music came through, the image came through, and as they dig down, there's just, you know, Robert Osborne at Turner Classic Movies, who I worked with for years, used to have this saying, because, you know, we were a network devoted to classic film, and all of us that were there loved classic movies. And he used to say, oh, how I envy the person who hasn't seen Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Because they're going to get to see it for the first time one day, and it's going to change their life. Or, man, can you imagine being the person, you've never seen Brando in The Godfather. Oh, my gosh, you're just, and I envy the person who hasn't heard Elvis yet, because that's all it's going to take. As Jerry Schilling said, you get Elvis in front of the young people and Elvis will take care of everything. He's been doing it since, you know, July of 1954, and it continues on.
Which we will talk about.
We're going to talk about that. And speaking of 1954, again, another one of those stories that just kind of popped up out of nowhere. Everybody knows it's an Elvis fan, remembers that 70 years ago, in July of 54, Elvis cut That's All Right, Mama. It was just 3 months later that he was appearing on stage at the Grand Ole Opry at the Ryman Theater in downtown Nashville in a performance that did not go quite as popularly well as he had hoped it would. And the manager of the Grand Ole Opry told him he needed to go back and drive a truck.
Whew.
Yeah. Just 3 months after he had cut That's All Right, Mama. And now, 70 years later, the Ryman and the Grand Ole Opry embracing that legend of the one-hit wonder, Elvis Presley, on the stage of the Grand Ole Opry at the Ryman. And they've got a new exhibit called From Memphis to the Ryman. And it's narrated by a guy in Old Dominion, the country band, Matthew Ramsey. And it's going to revisit that Presley show. Guitar player Scotty Moore, Bill Black have recollections there through a series of photographs and artifact displays. And they say that it's really going to show about that night and the aftermath, because not only did Elvis sing That's All Right, he sang The King of Bluegrass, Bill Monroe's Blue Moon of Kentucky, in a way that even Bill Monroe was not very happy with until the royalty checks started coming in.
Right. Funny how money does that very thing.
Yeah. Irving Berlin didn't like the way that Elvis recorded White Christmas. And he said that he should, you know, he'd never wanted Elvis to record any of his music until he got a royalty check. And then the telegram supposedly said to Colonel and Elvis, I've written many other songs. If Mr. Presley would like to sing them, I would give him any rights to do that. So, so they did not like the rendition of Blue Moon of Kentucky. But the things that are in that display at the Ryman, the 1954 contract that Elvis signed with Sun Records just 64 days before he stepped on the Ryman stage. And it also has the royal blue suit that he wore on the Grand Ole Opry.
Wow.
And there's a lot of personal items there from Bill Monroe, also Sam Phillips and Hank Snow, who Elvis was working with. And it's going to be a part of the tour. If you get tickets to tour the Ryman, it's part of the tour of the Ryman in downtown Nashville. So Elvis, you know, Lisa Marie years ago finally got to play the Grand Ole Opry, and I was with her the weekend before she was going to be going to Nashville. And we were sitting in the lobby of the Peabody on a sofa with a bunch of people. And I just was talking with her about it. And I said, you know, Lisa, I hope it goes better for you than it did your dad. And she said, yeah, I've heard about that. I said, well, you know, you don't have truck driving to fall back on, Lisa. So right. Hope it goes well. And I don't know if you've remember hearing that, but the next week I was listening to that on the radio because we were living in Nashville at the time. And Lisa said, but after one of the songs, something about having a truck, you know, it's okay, I've got a truck parked outside. She said something about a truck, and I thought, I wonder if she said that because I reminded her.
Well, she had to have, you know. There, I've been fortunate. I've sang at the Grand Ole Opry where it currently is over by Opryland. But I also had the great privilege of singing on stage in front of a full house at the Ryman Auditorium. I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry a cappella. I was doing a show with Marcus Hyman, great songwriter, and he was talking about his influences, one of them being Hank Williams as a writer. So I got to sing I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry a cappella, packed house, center stage, Ryman, the best acoustics, and I've sang all over the world that I've ever experienced. And there's nothing like it. I got to meet Merle Haggard backstage at the Ryman, Winona Judd, all kinds of people. And but I do, and I'm glad they're doing it, of course. But there is a little bit of me going, yeah, okay. You told him to go back to driving a truck, kind of like kicking Hank Williams off the Grand Ole Opry. But boy, they got museums for both of them, don't they?
Well, you know, I got friends at the Grand Ole Opry, Jeff. So I will say that was the Opry's version of Tough Love, and look how they inspired Elvis to go on and succeed.
Yeah, that's right. And Hank Williams might have deserved his departure from the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, at the time, you know.
At the time, yeah.
I don't think they were big fans of Johnny Cash either at yeah. some point or another. But
if you get a chance, folks, go tour the Ryman, the history of it. It's a beautiful building, and it is really the mother church of country music, and it's just a fantastic venue.
And I have a friend, T. Graham Brown. We are not cousins, even though we call each other cousins. And Tinus has been, he had these huge hits back in the 90s. And he's just been a member of the family of the Grand Ole Opry, but never a member. And just a few months ago, he was finally honored to be inducted as a member of the Grand Ole Opry. So congratulations to T. Graham Brown for finally getting this man in the Grand Ole Opry. He is just the coolest guy. His name is Tony Brown, but he couldn't be Tony Brown because, Jeff, as you know, there was already a Tony Brown in Nashville. Yes. So Cousin T, and I would go see him a lot with Lisa when we lived there. And every time he would recognize me in the audience, have me stand up. And I was always up in the balcony, and he would have me stand up as his cousin. And the people around me, as I sat down, would go, I could hear them saying, you'd think he'd get his cousin a better seat than that, wouldn't you?
Well, T. Graham Brown is a huge influence on me vocally. And I was in Nashville when all of his hits were happening. Mike Owens, my best friend that passed, was close with him. And believe it or not, back in those days, I had an exquisite mullet.
Mm.
And I got confused for T. Graham Brown all the time. And when I tell people, they'd ask for my autograph, and I go, but I'm not T. Graham Brown. They'd almost get upset. So I just started signing T. Graham Brown's name on things. So there are people, and I apologize, who simply didn't believe I was not T. Graham Brown back in 1991 and 92. And so, T, you have a lot of people with allegedly your autograph, courtesy Jeff Lewis.
Yeah, I tell it like I used to be. Oh, my gosh, yeah. What a song.
Great.
And it was with T in the alley out there behind the Ryman. T's the one that introduced me to T.G. Shepherd, part of the Elvis world. And it became one of the nightmares of my life when I was around them, because try to keep T and T.G. straight when you're in having a conversation. It's a nightmare. So I called T. Graham Cuz. So that's the only way I could keep it straight. Jeff, you know, I'm name dropping, you know, T. Graham as my cousin. This is one of my favorite stories. Alex, if you haven't heard this story, indulge me. Jeff, this is one of my favorite stories. You, Ryman Auditorium, Merle Haggard.
That is one of my favorite stories. I'm on my boat out on the lake, and a friend of mine, she knew Merle real well, and called me and said, did you know Merle's at the Ryman? I said, yes, I did. She goes, would you like to meet him? I said, of course I would. So I had a little two-stroke pontoon boat that went about 10, 15 miles an hour. I'm just hauling back to the dock. Time to run home and shower. I'm sunburned. And I get to the Ryman, and the coolest thing you can ever do if you're a fan of country music and its history is walk from the back door Tootsies, the old Tootsies anyway, go up that alley and go up to the back door of the Ryman. That's what Hank Williams did, Willie Nelson, everybody, Patsy Cline. It's just a famous little area, probably the most famous 15 feet historically.
They were like 36 steps to stardom right there.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so just getting to do that on occasion was great. So I get up there, and it come to find out, the girl's there, and she goes, yeah, you're okay to be back here. I believe the guy's name was Frank. It's Merle Haggard's road manager, and that back when I was a grown-up and was a claims adjuster, I had a claim with him and, you know, really treated him right and, you know, gave him a good deal and all that stuff and helped him out. And he remembered that, and so I saw him, and Frank, how you doing? He goes, great. Do you want to meet Merle? I go, I'd love to. So he goes, well, stand right here. And he put my back against the wall. The backstage of the Ryman is not a big place.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, you know, nervous because I had heard you don't really want to meet Merle unless you catch him on a really great day. So I was kind of nervous about that. Well, the back door opens and short guy wearing a cowboy hat and a T-shirt steps up. And I look at him, and I'm probably 10, 15 feet away, and there's Merle Haggard. And for me, there's Elvis, and then there's Merle, you know, and those are my two guys. And I can't believe I'm seeing him, and I'm that close to him. And Frank goes, Merle, I want you to meet a friend of mine, Jeff Lewis. And Merle's looking straight ahead, and he's a few inches shorter than me. And he walks over, and he never looks up, and he keeps walking, and the bill of the cowboy hat, the front of the cowboy hat, is pressing against my chest. And all I can think is, oh, crap, I met him on a bad night. You know, and I just thought, well, just smile, you know, and that's it. And he slowly looked up, and folks, close your ears if you're allergic to a bad word. But it's not a bad word, really, if you think about it. Anyway, he looks up real slow, and he goes, big son, bitch, ain't you? I was like Richard Pryor stir crazy when he's in the jail. I said, yes, sir, I'm a big son, bitch. I sure am. Yes, sir. and he goes, well, I want you to wait right here. And I go, can I get a picture? And he kind of rolled his eyes and said, sure. And he turned around. I had the camera ready. And you can see in this picture, I'm the biggest dork. I've got the dumbest grin on my face, but there's Merle Haggard, and I'll have it forever. And he told me not to move. And they're playing his intro music. Da, 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 you know. Yeah. So he goes out, does an incredible show. I don't budge an inch. Comes back in, looks at me, goes, all right, follow me. Yes, sir. And we walked over to the back door of the Ryman, and they opened the door, and he's going to sit there and sign autographs. And he wanted me behind him. And he looked at me, and he goes, I want you to get rid of all the a-holes. We didn't say a-holes. Mm-hmm. I said, yes, sir. I don't know, about 10, 15 people back in the line. There's this drunk idiot, and he's going, Merle the Pearl, woo! And he's acting like an idiot. And Merle looks up at me real slow, and he goes, that would be one of the a-holes. That's why I walked down there and grabbed that guy by his ear, get the hell out of here. And I walked him off the line and told him to get rid of the guy. And then got on the bus, and he signed a couple things for me. And he went back to his room in the back of the bus. There were a few girls on the bus with us, and I looked at the one I knew, and I said, well, it's time for me to go. It was a perfect night. Yep. That's my Merle Haggard story.
There you go. I love that story. There's one of them right there.
Yeah, I thought that was a moment I'll never forget.
That's, you kind of get that feeling anytime I walk up to you, too. I'm about the size of Merle Haggard. So.
You are. You're right at it. Yeah, wear a cowboy hat. You'll be there.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we've talked about the imminent foreclosure of Graceland. We've talked about a new book from Lisa Marie, and we've talked about Elvis at the Ryman and Haggard at the Ryman. And, of course, all those great licks from those Haggard songs back in the 60s would have been a little guy from Shreveport, Louisiana named James Burton. So there is an Elvis connection.
Yes, that's right.
All those great licks. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, it's the story of That's All Right, Mama from July of 1954.
Tom, I literally, when you said that, got goosebumps on my legs. I know what's coming, yeah, and I just got goosebumps.
Ladies and gentlemen, after this break, one of the next voices you hear will be the greatest game show host, television personality in history, Wink Martindale. Coming up!
I can't believe it.
Greetings from Wink Martindale and Game Show Network.
We are going to have a ball.
Get ready for tic-tac-toe.
It's going to be wild.
The questions can be tough.
Three island territories send delegates to presidential conventions. Name two.
Puerto Rico.
Right.
And Guam.
Right for tic-tac-toe.
There's plenty of excitement.
To believe it, you got to watch it.
And it always pays to avoid the dragon. Tic-tac-toe, the place where X's and O's can have you rolling in dough.
Thank you so much, Wink, for being a part of Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talking. You've been on our list for a long time to get to, and I think it's only perfect that this podcast airs, and we're going to be talking about events in July of 2024, and July of 54 was a very important month and year in music, especially in Memphis, and it wasn't just Elvis who was making inroads in July of 54. It was also Wink Martindale, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was very proud to be a part of the, you know, that period of time that really kicked off rock and roll in Memphis, Tennessee. I did the morning show at WHBQ Radio, and I just happened to be at the radio station the night that Sam Phillips, founder of Sun Records, walked in with an acetate, a recording that he had made 2 hours earlier with his truck driver named Elvis Presley. And he wanted Dewey Phillips, the nighttime jock, to test it on his show to see if he had anything. And Dewey was hot as a firecracker. And if he played a record and it had anything, it'd be a hit the next day. So he played this acetate called That's All Right, Mama, first Elvis record ever made. And the switchboard lit up. And from that day forward, I mean, you know, the rest is history.
It's interesting because that acetate was kind of lost to history.
Yes.
After all those years. And at some point in the recent past, Angie Marchese, the VP of Archives, found it online in an auction of items. And it was not particularly an Elvis auction. It was just a bunch of music and historic items.
And it
got thrown in, and she was able to verify what it was. And Graceland purchased it. And leading up in the days leading up into Elvis's birthday celebration in January of 24, she posted cryptic Facebook things, leaving hints as to what this item could be.
Like
boom, you know, like the big boom of rock and roll, all these little things, the big bang of rock and roll, all these little hints that she, and one of the people that she particularly didn't tell she had was you. And the morning of Elvis's birthday celebration, she had a record player, and she had that acetate that you had shared a room with in July of 1954, and that was the last time you ever saw it.
Yeah.
And you guys were reunited on the lawn of Graceland. What was that like to, you literally, one of the great DJs of all time, you were able to drop the needle just like Dewey Phillips had done 50 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, it's my understanding they paid $30,000 for that acetate, that original acetate.
Yeah.
Anyway, wow. It was such an honor for me to be able to drop the needle on that acetate as I had done back in 1954. It's almost like, you know, an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, on this little record player comes, well, that's all right now, mama. That's all right with you. You know, and it just, it was such a fabulous, well, that whole day, that whole week, that weekend was fabulous. I still look back on that period of time we got to spend with you and everybody there, Tom, in Memphis during that period. And it was cold, but not that cold. Mm-hmm. And it was just really a wonderful time.
It was interesting to and take us back, if you would, to that WHBQ studio, because that night, like you said, you did the morning show. That was an evening that Dewey was on with Sam walking in. You were not there to work. You were there as a tour guide.
Yeah, I was showing some friends of mine from Jackson, Tennessee, that I had played high school football with around the radio station. And right in the middle of my little tour, I heard this commotion coming out of Dewey Phillips' studio, and I said, excuse me. And I went up there, went up the ramp, went into his studio, and like you said, Sam had just walked in with this acetate of this song that he had recorded earlier called That's All Right, Mama. And Dewey had put it on the turntable to play it to see if they had anything. And of course, as I said, the switchboard lit up. And from that day forward, nobody had to tell anybody who Elvis Presley was. I happened to be the one who was designated to call Mr. and Mrs. Presley to find out who this guy named Elvis was. Where was he? So Mrs. Presley answered the phone, and she had been listening that night because she knew that Dewey was going to play That's All Right, Mama. And they were excited about it. And of course, they got more excited because the switchboard lit up. And I said to Mrs. Presley, where's Elvis? We'd like to get him to come down to the station. And she said, well, he was so nervous about his record being played. He went to see a double feature Western. He's at the Sousa's Theater. I think it was on Decatur Street. Anyway, they got in their truck. They went down to the theater and walked up and down the dark aisles. And there was this guy named Elvis Presley sitting there by himself watching this movie, this Western movie. And they whispered to him about the commotion being caused by the playing of his record. And of course, he was excited, came down to the station. I met him that night, and he became my friend and was my friend till the day he left us.
The legend has it that, you know, like you said, the Presleys did know that that was going to be played that night, as Elvis would have known.
Yeah.
And he just didn't want to hear himself, or he was nervous, or do you know what the reasoning was behind him scooting to the movie?
All that they told me was that he was so nervous about his record being played that he didn't want to be a part of that. And so he went to see a double feature Western at the Sousa's Theater. And that's all I ever heard from them about why he wasn't more a part of that night.
Think about that. History being made on the air in Memphis, and he's so afraid of what's going to happen. Little did he know that that was the night that was going to change everything for him.
You know, the next day, all hell broke loose, really. not in all of the South or other parts of the country, but just regionally in the Memphis and Mid-South area. This record by this new truck-driving singer named Elvis Presley, this song, That's All Right, Mama, took off like a, you know, craziness. Yeah. And it became, of course, his first regional hit. And later, when it was distributed on RCA after 1956, it became a hit all over again.
You were incredibly lucky, well, talented to be at WHBQ Radio, but you were amazingly fortuitous and lucky to be in what became the center of the birth of rock and roll, being a DJ and kind of being able to grow up with the music yourself, because it was being created right down the road from the Chiska Hotel.
That's right. We were in the as Dewey used to say, the magazine floor of the Chisco Hotel, and I did the morning show, and was so lucky to be a part, as you said, of that period of time from 1952-53 through 56 forward. I remember that in the morning on WHBQ radio, unlike Dewey Phillips, who was playing rhythm and blues and rock at night, I wasn't allowed to do that. In the morning on my show, I was playing things like I Need You Now by Eddie Fisher and You Belong to Me by Joe Stafford. And at night, of course, Dewey was given the okay to do whatever he wanted to do, because he was bringing in a ton of money at night, thanks to the sponsors of his show. And he was he was introducing us, really, in that time frame, to the music out of Specialty Records out of Chicago, and so many of those R&B labels that heretofore had never been heard in Memphis. And all of a sudden, we're hearing a kind of music that, thanks to Dewey Phillips and his nighttime show, that we had never heard before. So in the morning, I'm playing this kind of music. Midday, they're playing the same kind of music I was playing. But at night, all hell broke loose when Dewey came on from 9 to midnight. And it was really a time in Memphis that we'll never see again, not only in Memphis or anywhere. But that period of time from 1954, 55, 56, I had the privilege and the pleasure of being a part of and seeing a change in music forever as we had known it to that day.
Yeah. And, you know, you said not to see it at that era, not to see it again. In a way, I was thinking in my mind, the closest I'll ever be able to get, and all of us will be able to get, are the Memphis Beale Street scenes from Baz Luhrmann's film, the recreation of Beale Street and Elvis's love of African-American music and culture, really, and just so much comfort he had among that musical style and that feeling of Memphis. When you saw the Baz Luhrmann movie, what were your feelings about the Memphis scenes of that? Because we saw Mr. Lansky in the film, and we saw Lansky Brothers, and we saw how important music and culture were coming together for African Americans, and how much Elvis was embracing that at the time. What were your thoughts on the Memphis scenes in Baz's film?
What I remember most, as you mentioned, were the scenes on Beale Street, Lansky Brothers, and what Lansky Brothers meant to the culture of Memphis in that day and time. I was, as you know, I was fortunate this past year in Memphis to get my note on Beale Street. Mm-hmm. They have notes on Beale Street implanted in the concrete. And so I have that honor. But In that day and age, it was just music and the times and the place. It seemed like everything changed so much in the early 1950s through 1956, 57. And of course, by 1960, everything was rock.
Yeah.
It was very few ballads in that day and age. But I got to live through that. And that period of music was just really special from 54 through 56.
Yeah. And you, young Wink Martindale, there you are on the radio, but you're born and raised in Jackson, Tennessee, just down the road from Memphis.
85 miles from Memphis, yeah.
Much like Elvis, about 100 miles from Memphis, growing up born and raised in Tupelo. What did Memphis represent to small town Winston Martindale there in Jackson, Tennessee? And how did you make it to Memphis from Jackson?
Well, from the time I was old enough to know the difference between a microphone and a speaker at the other end of that microphone, I wanted to be on the radio. It was all I ever wanted to do. I guess from the time I was 8 or 9 years old, I wanted to be a part of radio. This is years before television, of course. We didn't have television then. But I wanted to be on the radio. And in Jackson, Tennessee, it just so happened that when I was 17 years old, my Sunday school teacher, Chick Wingate, also happened to manage the local 250 water there in Jackson. We had three stations. 250 watt, WPLI, we had WTJS, 1,000 water, and 5,000 water, WDXI. Well, of course, I had no dreams to be on the two bigger stations, but I used to be on my my Sunday school teacher, Chick Wingate's tail all the time. Chick, when are you going to get me a job? When are you going to, I want to be on the radio. When are you going to get me a... So finally, he got fed up. One night, a bunch of us were sitting on the railing in downtown Jackson, by the First National Bank building. And on the fourth floor was where WPLI, the little 250 water, was located. And we were sitting there just, you know, on a hot summer night, and up pulls Chick Wingate in his little Henry J. automobile. And he jumps out of the car. He had some business to do on the fourth floor at WPLI. And once again, I yell, Chick, when are you going to give me a, damn it, come on. So he took me up on the elevator, walked in on the fourth floor, tore some news copy off the newswire, gave me a couple of commercials, put me in front of that microphone, and he gave me what we know today as an audition. And I went through those things like Grant going through Richmond, because I've been, we didn't get a lot at Christmas time, but my dad used to get a $100 bill and a year's subscription to Life magazine. So I grew up reading, literally reading Life magazine from front to start. From front to end. And so I took great pride in my reading ability. So Chick Wingate says, look, you come down here tomorrow after school. I was 17, just graduating from high school. He said, you come down here and I'll have George Smith here, who owned the radio station. He was the mayor of the town. And he said, if you do as well tomorrow as you did for me here, I think you'll have a job. So sure enough, next day, I'm on my bike after school down to the radio station, fourth floor, same microphone, same copy. And Mayor Smith was there. I remember I was so thrilled. The mayor of the town was there to hear me, you know, do my audition. And I knocked it out and I got the job, $25 a week. And that was my beginning in radio. And I was there for about a year. And then I moved on to the 1,000 water. And I remember I went from like $25 a week to $45 a week at WTJS. And then after I was there for about a year and a half, I moved on to the 5,000 water, WDXI. And I was by then making about $80 a week. So Jackson, Tennessee has always been a great fond memory for me, because it gave me the opportunity to do what I always wanted to do with my life, and that is be in show business of some sort, beginning in radio and then, of course, later in television. And it served me well.
You know, Jeff, I was just thinking as Wink's telling his story about, you know, he knew he was going. I had the same feeling, Wink. I've told you this many times. I knew, watching people like Johnny Carson, people like yourself on television, that is what I wanted to do. I want to be in broadcasting in some way. I don't want to be an actor, but I want to be me. I want to have a microphone, and I want to be able to talk and communicate. And it's amazing how, and I know Jeff was gifted with a singing voice, and Alex is gifted with his singing voice and with his technical ability, that we all seek out things that we are talented in. Some of us succeed and some of us aren't as lucky. And it's just amazing to see that how many of us are pursuing our loves, and that you were doing that at the time. And I know you're like me, and Jeff, it's fascinating to me to talk to a broadcaster. We all remember call letters of everywhere we've ever worked.
You never forget them. Never forget.
The only difference is you guys knew you wanted to be DJs. I wanted to either play for the Dallas Cowboys, coach the Dallas Cowboys, or be a championship wrestler. Now I'm in the Elvis business, so you figure that out if you can.
You're still entertaining, you see. That's right. That's what you're doing. Well, Wink, it's a fascinating story. I mean, what got you then to Memphis and pursuing that? And you during our event in January at Graceland, we were doing the interview, and part of our interview was that presentation for you of your star on Beale Street to be forever immortalized there among your friends like Elvis and Jerry Schilling and Sam and all those people doing.
Yeah, who are those people?
Yeah, exactly. And I was just there the other day for an event with Priscilla, and I made sure to shine you up. You're going to be looking good now. Got you all shined up. But it's interesting when you were telling me in this interview in January, a schedule for you, a typical day for you when you were at Memphis State. Yeah, you had a morning shift, you had classes, you had TV even. I mean, take us through that. You were telling me about this day, and Jeff, Alex, this is the schedule of somebody that knows they're in broadcasting and that they don't, and it's not even work to them. Tell us that schedule.
Well, at WHBQ, did the morning show, had to be there at 5 o'clock. In those days, we didn't, we went off the air at midnight. And so I had to be there at 5 o'clock to turn the radio station on. I had an engineer at the transmitter, but I had to be there to literally turn the thing on and get things moving at 5 o'clock. So I was married at the time, and I'd just gotten married, and I was going to John Cleghorn, who managed WHBQ radio and television. He talked me into going back to college. He said, "You know, you may be successful as you want to be, but," he said, this will be the only time you'll ever have to get your college education." And he said, "I strongly feel that you should do that while you can." And so I decided to try to get my degree at the University of Memphis, which then was Memphis State. So I would go on the air, turn the station on at 5 o'clock. I would get off at 9 o'clock, and I would literally run downstairs, get a bite to eat in the coffee shop, into the car, out Park Avenue, out to Memphis State. And I would be there. I took 16 hours, and I would be in school until 3 o'clock, and then I would leave Memphis State, and I would go to WHBQ television, which at that time was on Madison Avenue. And I was doing a show called Wink Martindale of the Mars Patrol, my first television show. So I would be there, do that, finish that at 5:30, and then go home and get ready to do this all over again, which I did 6 days a week. So I guess I've always thought that, you know, you can do things like that when you're young. Mm. But when you get to be my age today, ain't no way. Ain't no way, brother, that Wink Martindale can do that.
Yo, speaking of your age, I just want to get this on the air. That, to me, this is one of the funniest lines I ever had. And Wink, I just want to thank you for doing this, of course. But you and Sandy have always been so wonderful to me. Every time I'm around you, I love your stories, and y'all are just some of the kindest, sweetest people ever. Do you mind if I say your age?
No, I don't mind at all. I'm proud that I've made it this far.
Hey, when you said you're 90 years old, I could not believe it. And what I said to you that one night, I said, "Wink, I would give anything to look like you at my age." I'm still just proud of that line. So I wanted it there immortalized forever.
I don't know. You know, I feel blessed because I know that, I've heard from everybody. I certainly don't look, you know, my age 90, but I just feel blessed that I feel the way I do. I still am in a good health as far as I know. And I look forward to, I don't know how long the good Lord's going to allow me to walk this planet, but I look forward to every day that that comes my way.
Wonderful.
Well, it's been a blessing to be with you because your enthusiasm is contagious. The audience at Graceland among them, and when you let's not forget the moment Sandy and I somehow got separated from you walking to the ceremony the morning of the birthday cake cutting.
Yeah,
we got separated from you, and we looked behind us, and they were playing Elvis Christmas music. And here's Wink skipping down the yard, dancing to Elvis music in front of all the fans, doing a pretty good time step, actually. It was and
that's stretching it a little bit.
Either that or you were stumbling in rhythm. I'm not really sure.
That's more like it.
But you really are a testament to you're as old as you feel that you are, and you don't feel that you are. And you and Sandy always are up for an adventure.
Yes.
I tell you the truth, I feel so good today. And I look forward to every day. And of course I have this person on my left who I want to call in now to say hello to you guys. And
all right.
And she leads me through life, and we've been, we're on our 49th year of marriage, and it's the best move I ever made. I married up. There's no question about it. Hello,
you know? Ladies and gentlemen, Sandra Martindale now joining there the festivities.
Look
there
how
she
beautiful
is.
You look.
Look at you.
Oh, y'all look great.
Thanks.
That's a TV commercial picture right there, man.
Really?
Wish y'all could see it.
I feel like I'm on Tattletales.
You know,
you guys used to be in little boxes, the video in a little box, and friends. So all of us right now on this Zoom call are all in little boxes. I feel like Bobby Darin or Bobby Van, who was the host of Tattletales.
Oh, I miss him.
Oh, he was one of the.
Oh, wasn't it Mark Convy, darling?
Well, I remember Bobby Van. Maybe that was a nighttime edition or something.
Yeah,
I'm not
sure. Yeah, maybe.
But you know what? There was another big fan that you guys had. You were very early in your marriage when you were on Tattletales, but you had another fan that loved to watch you on Tattletales.
Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
Tell that story. Because mm-hmm. He had seen us that day.
Yeah, he saw us that. Well, it was Wink's birthday in 1976.
Who's counting?
I am. in Las Vegas for Wink's birthday. And we went backstage and
between shows.
And he said, I saw you guys on Tattletales today, and I couldn't believe how much you know about each other. Said, yeah, we do. We know a lot about each other. But he was so, I mean, we had such a good time with him. That was the last time we saw him. And yeah. He told Wink, he was saying to Wink, look at you, Wink. Look at your career. Look how well you've done.
Look at how well I've done.
And he said, what's wrong with this picture? And then he said, first he told Wink that my mom came on his first 3 dates with me. And Wink said, well, she told me that, but I didn't believe her. But since Elvis was telling him, then he believed it. And then Elvis also said that I usually, before Lisa passed, I would say, he said, I was one of the nicest girls from one of the nicest families he ever knew. But a girlfriend of mine recently said, Sandy, you own what he said, and you should say exactly what he said was, I was the nicest girl from the nicest family that he ever knew. And I own that.
And we went, we left his dressing room that night, and we went back to our hotel. And I'll never forget, we closed the door behind us, and we both cried. Because we knew that was the last time we'd ever see him alive. He was looked, you know, very. He didn't look good in those days.
Yeah.
Big,
yeah.
Overweight.
And he was my hero. And he used to always say to me, you know, when I was young, of course, Sandy, you know, you've got an Italian heritage. You got to be careful. You could gain weight. Well, all of my life, geez, I get on 2 different scales every morning, and I've done that all my life.
I mean, look how fat she is.
Oh, my gosh.
No, but he, you know, he was my hero, and I looked up to him, and he formed so many of the thoughts and things in my life. And then to see him that day and to see him perspiring and all puffy, it was like, how could this possibly happen? It was just. It was more, even thinking about it now, it could make me cry. It was just more than we could really handle. And then when he did die, the two of us sat there, and we literally we mourned for 2-3 weeks nonstop. And the good thing was we had each other because we both loved him, and we got to mourn together.
Yeah. You know, sometimes the dream of what you want in life, sometimes you get it. And sometimes it's a curse that you get what you dreamed about. And obviously you two, you know, just because of the kind of people that you are with having each other, I would wonder for him, especially Wink, you know, he was someone that he could point to you and to Sandy, but he could point to you and know that you were a friend before he became anyone that could help him be Elvis Presley. There was nothing you were asking from him at the time that you met him in 54 because he was undiscovered yet. And so, like I've always said about people like Red West and people like that, that how do you know who to trust when you're at that level? You've been in show business a long time. How do you know who to trust? And
he trusted me because he knew I didn't want anything. I didn't want to be in photographs with him. I didn't want to turn my head if we were somewhere at a movie or something. I didn't want publicity because I knew he didn't really like girls that were interested in publicity. So I wanted him to know I was just interested.
Of course, I'd met him that night in 54, but it wasn't until 56 when he went west to make his first movie, Love Me Tender, and he came back to Memphis and was, I didn't go out of my way to invite him to be on my top 10 dance party because I figured, well, you know, this is Elvis Presley we're talking about now. This is not just Elvis, what's his name, from 1953-54. But he actually called and asked about being on the show. So that's when we did the interview that we videoed. We didn't have videotape in 56, but somebody suggested that I get a cameraman to come in. So Bob Zimmerman, a local cameraman guy, brought his 16 millimeter camera and set it up in front of the jukebox where I used to do my interviews. And that's how I captured the 18 or 19 minutes with Elvis Presley, which I still have to this day.
First one, right? That was the first TV interview ever with Elvis?
It was the first, televised recorded interview that was ever done with EP.
And we see Elvis's youth and exuberance and Wink's youth and professionalism. And we also know, Wink, you told me the other part of that story that some people don't know is that wonderful piece of footage that is so historic and so important earned you a lifelong enemy.
Not really.
What are you referring to? George?
I'm referring to a man by the name of Colonel.
Oh, yeah.
He never forgave me because he wanted me. He thought that EP should be paid for doing promotional appearances like on my show or whatever. Yeah. And of course, we didn't have any budget. We couldn't pay him. And we didn't pay him. But the colonel never forgave me for that. And from that day forward, I remember running into him at least once at RCA, and he wouldn't even speak to me. Wow. So, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And the one I was referring to is George got in some kind of problems in Memphis and he called Wink for help. So Wink loaned him the videotape. We didn't know what he was going to do with it, but Wink said, you know, here, because he thought it would help him. And we didn't find out till years later how it got to Graceland. He sold it to Graceland for six figures. And one day on an interview, he said, you remember that when that time you helped me out, Wink? And he said, I got six figures for that. No, we didn't know that.
Wow.
But it should be a part of Graceland history anyway.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, you're the interviewer, but let me ask you a question. Behind you is number 22. What does that mean?
Oh, that is a that is a signed jersey from the movie Longest Yard of Burt Reynolds. That it says Mean Machine on it. That's name of my production company is called Mean Machine 22, and it's after that jersey and the Burt Reynolds movie. We always again here's our mention of Burt Reynolds. Burt Reynolds is always
this is our one. This,
Alex keeps a running tab of how many times we bring up Burt Reynolds during our podcast.
But we didn't. Wink did. Wink brought it up.
Exactly. And that's what makes it so organic and beautiful. Thank you, Wink, for asking about that. That is pretty much beautiful. My entire office is this entire wall next to me here in Tupelo are seven one sheets from Burt Reynolds movies from the 70s that I, in fact, as a teenager, put up at the Lyric Theater here when I worked here. So all these posters are original to Tupelo in the 70s here in my office. So
let me ask you this now. You've been doing morning radio for how many years?
6 years here in Tupelo.
Okay. Do you still, I mean, you have to get up early.
I do.
It's not an easy gig, even though more people hear you than probably the combined rest of the day on your station. But do you still enjoy doing what you do in the morning?
I do, because I don't have class at Memphis State at 10 o'clock that I have to go to. And then I don't have to appear. Now, when I was in St. Louis in my 30s, back in the 90s, I did morning radio from 6 to 10. Luckily, the TV station was in the same building downstairs. I would go downstairs, prepare some pieces for the news at noon. About 1 o'clock, I would hurry home, and I would take a nap for an hour. And then I would come back at the TV station at 3 o'clock, put together stories for the 5 and 6 o'clock news, go out and do a live piece at a concert that night, and be back on the radio the next morning at 6 o'clock. But we can do a lot in our 30s, can't we?
What did you do in your spare time?
I flew to LA on the weekends and did interviews. Oh my God. I'm exhausted.
Wink said he got up at 5, and I'm like, yeah, that's about the time I went to bed.
Yeah. Oh, Wink, one morning I was on the radio and my phone rang, and it was Jeff calling me from Oklahoma. And Jeff's talking, it's about 5:45. I'm not on the air yet, but I'm getting all my notes together, and we're talking on the phone, and I just hear Jeff say to somebody, Yeah, that's Tom. And Jeff told him what your dad said.
Well, I was out back listening to all the birds wake up, and I was still up having a good time. And I was talking to Tom, and Dad opened the door and goes, "Is that Tom Brown?" I go, "Yeah, it's Tom." He shook his head and walked back in.
Because he knew I was the only one that would be awake at that.
He was the only friend awake. I just wanted to talk to somebody.
Jeff and I link up in the morning, and one of us is always awake throughout the day. There's always one of us. But I'll tell you the beauty of something I found out when I was in my 30s, Wink. The power of a nap is amazing, because sometimes it's almost like the radio show didn't happen that morning, you know, because I've done so much in the day. Yeah. But it's fun. It's not work. It's like you said. It's fun to get on, and I wait for the microphone to go on. I live for the red light. You know, there's no nerves involved. I'm nervous the rest of the day, but never when I'm on the air. I'm ready to, it's kind of like walking out on stage, and like with you, watching you, growing up watching you as an influence of just how to be so natural on camera and how to speak. And just, it's just, and it was always fun for me as a kid from the South to know that Wink Martindale started in Memphis. You know, I was watching Lance Russell and Dave Brown and those guys locally, and there's Wink on national television, and he was in Memphis on TV. My whole dream was to just make it to 485 South Highland, which was the eventual home of WHBQ. Yes, I remember the street address.
Do you know that in Jackson, when I was still, you know, on radio in Jackson,
yeah,
that Lance Russell was my color guy. I did the play-by-play high school football and basketball games, and Lance Russell was my color commentator. And Lance and I became very good friends because we also worked together at WTJS, the 1000 Water in Jackson. And then years later, you know, turn to black and come up on Memphis, Tennessee, and here's Lance Russell, who's managing the state. He owns everything.
Yeah, he was on the air. He did the Dialing for Dollars movie in the afternoon, yeah, live, and then he would do wrestling on the weekends. It was Memphis was an interesting town. Now, you eventually make it out of Memphis, and you make it to Los Angeles, and then the career really. You're now in Los Angeles. Now you're getting big time here. I mean, did you have a dream? You had a dream from Jackson to get to Memphis, but did the dream extend beyond Memphis?
Not really. It was Bill Grumbles, who was manager of WHBQ Radio and TV, who suggested that I think about moving to either Los Angeles or New York. We had WOR in New York, and RKO also owned KHJ in Los Angeles. So Mr. Grumbles said, where would you rather be? I said, well, New York kind of scares me. I think maybe L.A., So it was in March of 1959 that I got on an airplane and flew west and got out here. And it served me well. In 1959, I was doing the same thing for WR in New York. They had KHJ radio and television. And I was doing both radio and TV in L.A. as I was doing in Memphis. And so I just, you know, moved from one job to another and got into big time radio in Los Angeles, KFWB, number one station. And then by 1965, 66, I had become interested in something called a game show. So I auditioned for a game show called What's This Song, which was at that time a local show called What's the Name of That Song. And I got the job as host. They shortened it to What's This Song. It got on NBC. And that was my beginning as a host of game shows. And since then, hey, I don't know whether this is good or bad either. I couldn't hold a job or nobody wanted me. But I've either hosted or produced 21 different game shows over the years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's not unusual to go from DJing to television, because there was someone else in Los Angeles who was a DJ, and he ended up being Colonel Hogan on Hogan's Heroes. Bob Crane was a DJ.
That's right.
So that was a great way to be on the radio, being listened to by the movers and shakers of television and movies. Now, at some point, I feel like I'm doing, and this is your life, Wink Martindale. I have something from my vast collection here, and we'll post this online on our Facebook page.
This is a
photograph of exclusive on Dot Records, Wink Martindale, and you look to be about 22 or 23, or maybe this was taken last week. I'm not really sure, but it's this wonderful vintage. Tell me about appearing. I've heard some records by you, and actually, Alex, if you've got that sample, Sandy sent me something the other day, and I just thought we've got to take a second to listen to this. When I met my baby, she upset my nerves. My eyes started doing little dips and dirts. All love broke loose. All love broke loose. Well, my heart and soul were completely out of control. Well, I kissed my baby. And when she squeezed me tight. Oh, my goodness, Wink. I didn't know. Not only can you play the tunes, you can carry the tunes.
Tom, I got to interrupt. If everybody, I wish y'all could see what I just saw. That was Wink and Sandy dancing like they were 18 years old in high school. That was beautiful.
Love has broke loose at the Martindale house.
Yay!
tell us about the recording career. You also did another song that I've heard that's wonderful, and I've actually seen this 45 in the Memphis Rock and Soul Museum, Deck of Cards.
Deck of Cards, of course, was in 1959, and Randy Wood, who founded Dot Records, I had as a guest on my teenage dance party in Memphis one Saturday. And so when I came to California, Randy wanted me to come up to his office there on Vine Street and chat about being on the Dot label. So I couldn't wait to get up there. And he said, I have a piece of material that I think might be right for you. And it turned out to be a deck of cards, story about a soldier who used a deck of cards in church because he didn't have a Bible. And that was a hit in 1946, originally for a guy named T. Texas Tyler, who got the writing credit on it. So we went into a studio and did that in 1959. And I thought, this is in the middle of rock and roll. Who's going to buy a religious talking record? But sure enough, it came out. And by September, it was on the charts. And by October, I had been invited to fly to New York to do Deck of Cards on the Ed Sullivan Show, when the Sullivan Show was still, you know, the number one variety show. But those were fun times. I got to the Dot Records thing turned out to be a very, very important part of my life.
And you were a part of, there was a series of movies in the late 50s. Elvis is in the Army in 58, 59, so he's out of sight. There were a number of, and it kind of started, I guess, with Blackboard Jungle, the kind of a rock and roll movie kind of thing, where it was a very flimsy story of a couple, a young boy and a young girl, and they're trying to get together. But there appeared in these movies, you know, Chuck Berry's and Fats Domino. There were a lot of appearances by rock and roll singers in these movies. And That Love Broke Loose is one such case of you appearing in that rock and roll movie.
Yeah, that was a movie that we shot in New York with a lot of the artists you're talking about, and I happened to be lucky enough to have a part in there as a host on the show during the movie. And that's when I they gave me the opportunity to, since I had just made this dot record, to do All Love Broke Loose. And it wasn't a hit, but it did, it sold several thousand. And for this country boy from Jackson, Tennessee, 2,000 was pretty good. I'll take it every day.
Well, Sandy, you sent that to me, and I thought it wasn't an accident that it was right before we were getting ready to interview Wink Martindale. And for those of us, I'm of that generation, Wink, that it's you and Alex Trebek and Bob Barker and Tom Kennedy and Bill Cullen and Gary Moore, those game show hosts that we saw when we were homesick. Watching game shows, people don't understand how big game shows were in their time in the 60s and 70s. They were on all afternoon. They were on into they had nighttime versions. Peter Marshall from Hollywood Squares, Alan Ludden from Password. These are heroes of mine that I spent so much time with these people.
Well, most of the people that know me from television know me from Tic-Tac-Toe. Mm-hmm. Tic-Tac-Toe, mm-hmm. I hosted for almost 12 years. And, you know, in our business, as you know, that's almost a lifetime to have a job that lasts that long.
Yeah.
I just read the other day where Pat Sajak is getting to this month will be his last appearance on Wheel of Fortune. He's walking away from a job that pays him over $250,000 a year. He just don't want to do it anymore.
40 years. Yeah. 40 years.
Yes.
That show came on at the TV station here in Tupelo where I was working, had just started, and we did a local version. We did a cut-in during Wheel of Fortune. We would do a live one-minute segment at the top of the show where I would spin a wheel to get a count, to get an amount of money, $9 to $99, because we were WTVA Channel 9. And then I had a barrel with names in it, and I would turn the barrel and I would reach in and I would read a name off, and it would say, Jeff Lewis from Norman, Oklahoma, you've got 20 minutes to give us a call at the number on your screen and you'll be the winner of today's amount, $29. And now from Los Angeles, here's Pat and Vanna with Wheel of Fortune. And then I would come back on at the end of the show live for 10 seconds and say, hey, congratulations to Jeff. He called in. He's the winner of $89 tonight. You could be a winner tomorrow night. Just send your postcard to this address, and we'll see you tomorrow night on the Tupelo Wheel of Fortune. I did that live every afternoon. It's
that would make you a star.
That pretty much built me up. It built me up, it was.
I'll take that $89 in Louisiana, by the way. I'll see you.
With inflation, that's a pretty good amount of money now. I'll tell you.
I cannot tell you how many people come up to Wink. Because he was an English major and his enunciation and his pronunciation of everything is so clear, they'll come up and they'll say, Mr. Martindale, I have to tell you, when I came to this country, I learned English watching your game shows. And if one person has come up to us and said that, 10 people have come up to us and said that. So I said, here you are, an English teacher, and you didn't even know it.
See,
you were right. Wow.
And I have to brag on Wink and Sandy. They've been a part of so much of my life and helping me along the way, not only for being guests and judges the first year of the Nashville Elvis Festival when you came in. And we only had one rule we came up with. We called it the Sandy and Brenda rule. You can never put Sandy next to Brenda Lee. We learned that.
Because we don't. So, we went to high school together and we just don't stop talking.
Yeah. And it was so funny, though, to see them sitting talking and they would be talking. And I was on stage. I would glance down and I couldn't get their attention because they were talking. And Wink would look at me like, I'm not a part of them. I'm totally separate. If I could get another hotel, I would. I'm not a part of what's...
No, he would never say that. Not that. Anything but that. But we called, Brenda called Cody Little Elvis. And that
yes, Cody
was
Danis, yes.
Favorite. She said, oh, Little Elvis. And Little Elvis has come a long way since we judged him the first year he was in Tupelo.
Well, that's right. He's the current reigning ultimate champion.
That year in Nashville, of all the years we've been back there doing this sort of thing, That was more fun than ever.
Which one?
We had more,
Tupelo?
That,
the first one in Nashville.
In Nashville.
Yeah. That was great.
Wink went around with me, Alex and Jeff, went around with me doing local radio.
Yeah.
There in Nashville. And I got to be able to drive Wink around Nashville and walk in and see all the broadcasters coming out and in the hallways to see legendary Wink Martindale. Michael Del Giorno is one of your biggest fans.
I remember him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of those moments. But there was another moment I wanted to thank you for and tell this story about what kind of people that you're listening to. I was in a meeting when I was at Turner Classic Movies, which they're celebrating their 30th anniversary this year at TCM. We were having a meeting and we were talking about, we had had big plans. We were going to have a cruise, the very first TCM cruise. And they said, you know, one of the things we want to do on the cruise is a game show every night with movie trivia and things like that. And they said, Tom, do you think you could host that? And I said, well, because Robert Osborne, Ben Mankiewicz, they didn't want them to do it because they wanted to, you know, have them do other things. And they, you know, they figured Tom can do a game show. He can do that. And I thought about it and I thought, well, I could do it, but, and I'm talking myself out of a gig, but I said, wouldn't it be cool if we had someone like Wink Martindale to host the game show? And everybody's like, you mean legendary broadcaster and game show host from Tic-Tac-Toe 12 years, Wink Martindale? And I said, yes, that guy. And they said, well, yeah, but we'd never be able to get him. And I said, I'll be back in 5 minutes. And I walked out into the hallway. I called Wink. Because I had him in my phone, and I called him and I told him what it was. I gave him the dates, you know, what the cruise was going to be. And they were like, that sounds like fun. Walked back in. I said, okay, we got Wink Martindale. Anything else you need while I'm here? And Wink did it a couple of years. And then a buddy of yours, Alex Trebek, took over and ran with it. And the first year I was assigned to Alex to be his escort, much like I was assigned to Wink and Sandy to be their escort. And I learned so much about cruising on ships with Wink and Sandy. Like, immediately go to where the food is when you get on the ship. Immediately go there. So many things I learned. But when I first met Alex Trebek, I was kind of nervous because I knew you already. But, you know, Alex was an intimidating presence on Jeopardy. And I found out he was one of the funniest people I've ever met.
You never saw his funny side, I know.
I never saw it, but we got to see it during that game show. About 15 minutes into it, he would look over at me and go, Tom, wine me. And I would bring him his Chablis in a glass. And he was whole, because on Jeopardy, he didn't have time to be funny. He might get in one witty thing. But when I met Alex, I was intimidated. I walked up to him and I said, hi, I'm Tom Brown. I'll be your escort. And I stuck my hand out and I was about to tell him who I was. And he goes, oh, I know. I've heard all about you from Wink and Sandy. We'll have fun together. So you helped me with that. You had already briefed Alex Trebek on me. So thank you for that.
God puts people in our lives for a reason, and we don't know what the plans are, but somehow they all kind of link and come together at certain points.
That's right.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Just as we were talking, to have Wink in Memphis, to be at the station that night with those two football players or those two friends of yours, that you're doing a tour, and that's the night that rock and roll is born.
Yeah.
And your career from Jackson to Memphis, from Memphis to LA, from LA to this podcast. I mean, it's just it's an amazing career. You have to be really kind of proud of yourself.
Yeah.
And I know Sandy is.
That period in Memphis, of course, Memphis is where I feel like my career started. Not in LA or Jackson. Memphis was it. And that period that I enjoyed from that night in 54 in that control room, right on through the rest of that decade, to me, that truly made my career. I look back on that period of the mid to late 1950s, and that was it for me.
And I envy you for that era, because when we think of that era, we think of it in black and white, because that's how we see it in film and newsreels and photos. But you see it, I'm sure you see it in color.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So Elvis and Wink were friends for 10 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when I was young, what I prayed for is somebody that I could grow old with. Obviously, God knew it wasn't going to be Elvis, and he gave me Wink, and they were friends. And we've been married for 49 years this year. So
congratulations.
It's all part of God's plan. Plus everybody that's involved in the Elvis world, we love everybody. That, I mean, he put so many wonderful people together, and they're in our lives, you know, for the period of whatever time we have on the planet.
And I feel so fortunate that I'm, you know, I'm into my 91st year. You know, I'll be 91 my next birthday, December the 4th.
Yes, sir.
And I think, wow, what did I do to deserve this? And but here I am. And
the old joke is, you know, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. But Link, I don't know how you could look any better than you look now.
That's right.
He could have taken better care of himself, though.
Well, it's been that's a pleasure to have you here. And I'm so glad I was able to publicly thank you for so many wonderful moments that you've so many things you've done for me over the years, and always saying yes to any time I have a request for something. It means a lot to me. And for Alex and Jeff, I wanted them to spend some time with you, and along with the listeners too, to find out about Wink and Sandy. Cause I don't know if you know this or not, but you know, guys, when you're referred to as Wink and Sandy, it's Wink and Sandy.
And together. Not necessarily in that order.
Well, Wink negotiated first place.
Lead name.
But her name is higher in print. You're first. Wink is on the left, but Sandy's name is higher on the right. So I had a lot of people that I've met over the years doing the Elvis events, but you two have, I can truly call you friends from that.
Yes, and we are.
It's been great. And what a great time we had with Eric, your friend Eric, and Brian Mays, our co-producer of Nashville, and our friend and a publicist, and his wife Jess, all of us hanging out that morning on the lawn. We have a wonderful photo from the front steps at Graceland of that. It was a neat time. My favorite part of it, though, and I hope Winky don't get embarrassed by this, because I think you might have even said it in your speech. So we're there at the grounds, and it's a pretty big event, and it's a pretty big deal, and we're there, and everybody's all dressed up, and they look all good, and it's a chilly, cool day, and Wink pulls gloves out of his leather jacket pocket, and I see him kind of make a face, and he just shakes his head, and he puts them on, and I look at them, and I'm like, wow, those are interesting, cool gloves. They're white with blue latex on the fingers. Yeah. And I've got my leather gloves on. Everybody's got, and Wink has this. I'm like thinking, well, this must be what all the kids are wearing in Palm Springs. Wink, tell them what those gloves were.
I don't remember.
Those are his gardening gloves. He has beautiful leather, gorgeous gloves that I bought him. I said, did you bring your gloves? He said, oh, yeah. And I said, Wink, those are the gardening gloves.
You can take the country out of the boy, but blah, blah, blah.
There you go.
No,
So Wink began pruning the roses there in the front lawn at Graceland.
Always. He is the gardener.
Well, Tom, before we leave, I just want to, again, say thanks to you for giving us the opportunity to spend this time with you and with your listeners and viewers. And it's really a pleasure to be with you, but to also spend these minutes kicking around as many subjects as we've kicked around.
Really appreciate it. I have
1,000 more subjects. First of all, I miss being at Jeff's Gospel Sundays.
You're so sweet.
It's after we stay up late on the Saturday night with all that's going on with
the religion
winner, then we
at my after party
with no sleep and go to the gospel thing, and it's like, okay, I don't have to go to church today because you just bring it all right there, and it's wonderful.
Oh, that means so much. I wanted to share with you a quick story. When you mentioned Brenda Lee and the cruise, reminded me of it. And I was very fortunate to be on a cruise with her, and she's such a sweetheart. And I remember they had this little VIP party, and we're all sitting there, and it's kind of a meet and greet. And this lady walked up to Brenda and says, Connie Francis, I am your biggest fan. I love you so much. And Brenda, swear to God, she goes, well, that just means so much to me. And she turned around to me and she said, call me Connie Francis.
Well, I tell you something. People used to confuse Tom Kennedy and me to the point where we actually had T-shirts made that said on the back, I'm Wink Martindale, not Tom Kennedy, and vice versa.
He had the opposite. Yeah, he had the same shirt.
Well, thank you for that compliment, Sandy. Absolutely. That means more than you know.
No, it's such a special time. Anybody that goes to the Elvis thing in Nashville and gets to hear your gospel thing, and at all the other ones as well, it's a very special time. It's worth missing my sleep.
And listen, Tom, when the budget allows, I want you to invite Sandy and I to come back and take part in one of these events again.
We will do that. Definitely. Right. We will do that.
No, wait. We have to advertise. I have to get my commercial in.
For oh, that's right. That's partners. Right.
And we sell these glasses at the Graceland.
Oh, beautiful.
The year, I think it was either the 5th or the 10th anniversary, and we went back to participate. I may have been the time that you did the interviews with us. Mm-hmm. I wore these glasses, and I had them special made with my first love mm-hmm. and my last love. And all
says Elvis and Wink.
All the Elvis fans said, "Oh, Mrs. Martindale, I love your glasses. Where can I want them?" And I said, "No, I can't sell these glasses." But Priscilla and I know each other from the 60s. So she said, "Sandy, if you ever have a good idea, you know, just call me." So I sent her a picture of the glasses, and she said, "I like that. Let's do it." And so I've been selling them at Graceland ever since. But Elvis is on both sides. There's a watch with Elvis. Everything's Elvis. I got a purse that has Elvis on one side, but if we're promoting something with my honey, I turn it over and it's got Wink on the other side.
Your commercial time is up.
Okay.
We'll put the picture on the website for sure.
But let me tag on to that story. Wink and I were there with Sandy this past January at birthday, and Sandy had some suggestions on how they should better be displayed. Because they didn't, you couldn't see the stems, the bendy part of the glasses is called the stem, and they had them folded. You couldn't see them.
Yeah.
And so she had them unfold.
And
so
I
you
turned
could
them
see
around like this, but you know yeah. what? I went back the next day and they were back like this. I just give up. They just don't know.
Well, we thank you both for being a part of this. And, We will release you on good behavior now and back to your regularly scheduled life.
Okay. Yeah, you know, he quaffed for you this morning. So we're going out to dinner tonight with Judy and Allison Martino, who is Al Martino's daughter.
Oh, I love her website, her Vintage Hollywood.
Vintage LA.
Yeah.
Vintage LA, yeah.
She needs to start a vintage because she bought a house down here 2 years ago after we did. She came down here and she said, "Oh, Sandy, you're right. We got a place here now, too."
So we're having dinner with them tonight.
Yeah.
Well, remind her of me because she got in contact with me just before COVID about possibly wanting to come to Graceland to do a tour. And she wanted me to help her out and tell her we're still open to that.
No,
I'd love to have her here.
She has tons of people follow her.
Yeah. Tons. Yeah. That's the era of Hollywood that I love, that mid-century. So that's very cool. We want to thank you, Sandy. I just texted you something on your phone that if we could get Wink to do a liner for us, it would be really.
Did he get 10 cents a line or something? or a love me tender the next time we're in Memphis.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I'll take care of it.
Okay.
You've got it right there.
This is Wink Martindale, and you're listening to Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talkin'.
Perfect.
Well, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. That was just—he just said my name as Wink Martindale. Oh my gosh!
Hey, Wink, do one for us. That we're coming back from a break, you know. And now back to Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talkin'.
Okay. And now back to Tupelo Tom and Big Lou Talkin'.
Yeah. That's great.
We win. We are the champions.
I'd like to see the great Leslie try that one.
Guess what, Tom?
What's
you
that?
Win the brand new car.
Oh, I thought of you yesterday on the air. It was an anniversary of The Price is Right. And on the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of Price is Right, it said every prize was a brand new car. And I said it like you. I said, and every prize was a brand new car. And I also do a game quiz every morning at 7:30. And when I sign out of it, I say, you know, this is so-and-so, you know, the so-and-so quiz today. Thanks for listening. I'm Wink Martindale. Then I pause and I go, no, I'm not.
Okay, guys.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Enjoy it.
In 1955, a young truck driver stepped into a booth in Memphis to cut a song for his mother. And he's been trucking ever since. Elvis, the legend, kicked it off in the 50s when he turned on a whole generation of kids. Kids who would be the young musicians of the 60s and the superstars of the 70s.
Down in Louisiana, where the alligator grows on me, lived a girl that I swear to the world made the alligator look tame. Oh, Saturday night.
Elvis, the first superstar.
Got you ready.
Still the legend, still the artist.
Everybody said it was a shame.
In color from MGM, rated G, general audiences. Elvis, he didn't come back. We did. Elvis. Check, check,
check. Well, Big Lou, the history of That's All Right, Mama, and a little bit with Wink and Sandy Martindale from their beautiful home in California. And I'd say that's a... I'd say pretty much we got a little bit more to talk about, but the episode's over as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that was just so cool. And Wink is such a great guy. Sandy's wonderful. What an honor to be able to interview someone like that. I mean, first Elvis television interview, the history there. And I love that voice of his. And just what a guy.
Yeah. And as we were saying, you know, from Jackson, Tennessee, it just shows that there was some magic happening in Memphis. You know, there was just some magic happening in Memphis at the time. And for those fans out there who wonder, you know, I've known Wink now for close to 20 years now. And I will tell you, and Jeff, you know this too, and Alex, you know, he's the same guy.
Yeah.
That's not his professional persona that we were with there during that interview.
Right.
That's Wink. He is that way with absolutely everyone. He has time for everyone, and is still fascinated, loves television, is fascinated by broadcasting. He and I, you know, one of my big compliments one time was he said, "Well, Tom, how long have you been in broadcasting?" And I thought, oh, because broadcasting to me is just this magical world of when I was a kid, all I wanted to do was be on radio or TV. So
yeah,
the fact that one of the great broadcasters of all time asked me about broadcasting.
Oh. That's great.
Hey, there's some other stuff in the Elvis world that I wanted to hit really quickly before we do go. Now, you may have heard early in the year, they were talking about doing this Elvis hologram show, and it was from the company that was doing the ABBA hologram show. They built a special theater for the ABBA show in Norway, I think. Well, now there's that one going on that the ABBA people are going to do a hologram show on Elvis. They're talking with the powers that be that control Elvis's name and image. And that joins another hologram show that's already in progress called Elvis Evolution. That is a collaboration between EPE, ABG, and the immersive specialist Layered Reality. And that's due to launch in London in November, and then would go on tour in Las Vegas and Berlin and Tokyo. So there's, you know, Jeff, Elvis could be coming soon to a town near you, just like he did back
wonderful.
In the day on hologram. And again, just finding new ways for Elvis to be integrated into, you know, what's going on now.
Of course, if you've seen Bill Cherry live, you've seen the Elvis hologram. But that's just me.
Almost as close. Almost as close.
Right. Almost.
If you are still one of the people that buy DVDs or Blu-rays, coming on July 30th, Warner Archive, which is kind of the Warner Brothers section of DVDs and Blu-rays that are kind of made to order. When you order them, they produce them for you. Not the film I would have chosen for Blu-ray for 4K. An HD master in 1080p, but Harum Scarum coming out, so you can see everything in perfect, beautiful quality in high definition. It's got songs, and he's in a
karate chop and a little panther or leopard or whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to say about it other than it's Elvis in a rockin' swingin'.
Tom, they can't see Alex and I doing the recreating the karate chop.
Yeah,
here.
You are. You're doing karate chop. Just
exquisite.
Here's what they say about it. I want to get this right. Sheik meets Desert Sheik. You see what they did there. Sheik, like Sheik of Araby, meets Desert Sheik. Sheik meets Sheik when Elvis Presley plays Johnny and teams with former Miss America Marianne Mobley, Presley's Girl Happy co-star, in this tuneful frolic, partially shot on the original set built for Cecil B. DeMille's 1927 epic King of Kings and directed by musical veteran Gene Nelson. The kidnappers want Johnny to use his fighting finesse to kill a desert king. Johnny a hitman? No, he's a hit. Man, and a top singer of songs like Kismet, Harem Holiday, and nine more. All part of the jammin', scammin', swashbuckling fun of Harem Scarem.
That is, now I want to watch it.
See?
Wow. I'm up for some jammin', scammin' fun. I don't know about you guys.
I'm telling you.
That's a hit, man.
Johnny's a hit, man? No, he's a hit, man.
Oh, that is beautiful.
And listen, I don't know if that's a new copy or copy from the 60s, but to my friends at Warner Brothers, you're kicking butt with that. That was
wonderful.
And the special features on the Blu-ray,
yeah,
is a cartoon from Tom and Jerry called The Cat's Meowch.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and the original theatrical trailer for Harem Scarem. So there you go. Yeah, so get your Blu-ray now. Okay, now the next thing. This is pretty cool. There is something coming, and this is going to be released on August 9th. Legacy Recordings, part of Sony, they are releasing a multi-CD set and also 2LP, 24-track highlight album called Memphis. And what they're doing, they're going to take listeners, they say, through the many recordings Elvis had done while in Memphis. So we're going to go from Sun Records to American Studio to Stax, through his 1974 hometown show that was recorded and released that I attended, and finally the Jungle Room recordings. Now it's going to be 5 CDs, 111 tracks, 88 of which are newly remixed versions of select recordings, pure and without overdubs. So they're going back to the master tapes. My buddy Matt Ross Spang has gone back in and remixed these 88 songs, stripping away. We get basically what Elvis had in the studio. Now, a few days ago, they released on Spotify and all the music streaming services the Poke Salad Annie from March 20, 1974. And guys, I'm usually somebody that says, you know, remix. I don't see the difference. This is one of the most jamming remixes of Poke Salad I have. And I've heard this version 1,000 times. There are things going on instrumentally from Ronnie Tutt and Duke Bardwell on bass and JB on guitar that I've never heard before. It is going to open your eyes. And I urge you, as soon as you finish listening to this podcast, go find the Poke Salad Annie from the Memphis album. They just released it as kind of a teaser. 111 songs. The LP, that's for the 5 CDs. The LP will be 24 tracks. It goes from That's All Right, Mama and Blue Moon. You've got a lot of Sun LP masters. You've got In the Ghetto, Suspicious Minds, Don't Cry, Kentucky Rain from the American Sessions, Promised Land, Raised on Rock, all the Stax stuff, the Homecoming concert from 74, basically the entire Jungle Room session. So it's just amazing the stuff they're going to have. And part of the Elvis Week activities, we're going to be having a listening party. Sony's having a listening party for this. So they'll play they'll track this in the theater and you'll be able to sit there and listen to it. So we're going to be talking about the album and how it came to be. So just another way, a great package for the new Elvis fan. A lot of us already have these songs, but 88 remixed tracks. If you're a purist, these are what I call headphone songs. Because I told Matt Ross one time when he remixes, you put those headphones on and you're in the studio with what Elvis heard, what Felton heard in the control room, Felton Jarvis, his producer. It's like as close as like being there in the room with him. So that's Elvis Memphis.
You know, Tom, they're talking about the masters and redoing all that. That reminded me of a story real quick. There's a guy I was friends with in Nashville, and my mind went blank. Maybe you can remember. The old mastering studio right there on 16th that was there forever. I can't remember. All they did was they just went in and mastered every mm-hmm. single record and album and all that. Everyone ever. And I was talking to him one time about what was like the biggest record he'd ever done. He said, well, I've done them all, you know. But he said, I can tell you the most nervous I was. Tom, remember when they started coming out with all these new box sets? Mm-hmm. The last resurgence of Elvis that we had, you know, in the 80s and 90s before this latest one. Was he had to drive the masters of every single Elvis record to his studio to remaster them. Mm-hmm. He said he picked them up, gets in the big van, and starts driving and realizes every original master of Elvis Presley ever was in that van, and he was the one driving. He goes, I put my hazards on, and I went 4 miles an hour.
Oh, my
gosh. I was just honking every 10 feet, like, stay away, stay away. But it made me think of that with the remastering thing. I thought that was a great story.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, I can that's a short film right there somebody should make, you know,
right.
of a guy trying to get from point A to point B with somebody's entire career in the car, and everything keeps happening to him. Somebody,
right.
You know, a hitchhiker jumps in his car. There's a robbery going on down the street. I mean, just all this stuff happening to him, and he's just got all this stuff in the backseat. Oh,
really?
God. Well, listen, this has been our, you know, one of the episodes I've been waiting on all year to get to this anniversary of That's All Right, Mama. And Jeff, I know this is something that kind of started it all for us, isn't it?
I mean, it did.
That's All Right, Mama. It's everything. And today on the way here, I was listening to Sirius, the Blues Channel on Sirius, and Jeff, hand on the Bible or hand on my my Elvis albums, That's All Right, Arthur Big Boy Crudup played on as I was driving here today to come here to do this back to my house after lunch.
That's great.
So little signs like that.
That's happen. Right.
10-second miracle, Alex. 10-second miracle.
There it is.
All right. Jeff, I think that concludes today's programming.
I think we did another one.
Yes, yeah. I think we did. Well, I'm Tupelo Tom.
And I'm Big Lou.
And we're done talking.
Hey, man, we got two of them. Perfect.
Man, you know, perfection on the ends. Don't worry about the stuff in the middle.
But I'm going to be humble about it all day.
Oh, totally.
It's all about the humility. All right, well, as my boy back at Cowtown, the janitor used to say when the band was loading up, he'd say, well, we'll see you.
If you're driving home or not, don't forget to take your car.
And to you, too, I say goodbye. Tom knows that one.
You don't have to go home. You just can't stay here.